The sociologist Amita Babiska will converse with the historian and economist Rivka Wehuizen on public knowledge. This dialogue aims to discuss framing conditions of knowledge organization, the forms of access to knowledge, and its areas of application beyond familiar routines and thinking in socio-epistemic entities. Amita Babiska is an associate professor of sociology at the Institute for Economic Growth in Delhi. Her research focuses on the cultural politics of environment and development, and more recently she has focused on urban environmental politics, especially bourgeois environmentalism and spatial restructuring in the context of economic liberalization in Delhi. Rivka Wehuizen is Managing Director of the University of Strasbourg Institute for Advanced Study. Her research focuses on the psychological dimension of economic processes, mental capital and well-being, and how these are related to economic development and growth, and the psychological pathways in the relation between social capital and economic performance.
Right. Are we on?
I think so.
Okay.
So let me begin, Rivka, by asking you how you come to the issue of public knowledge.
Yeah, I'll tell you a little bit about my background so that you and whoever is on our channel will know where I'm coming from. So as already was said in the introduction, I have a PhD in economics and psychology, which is an interdisciplinary PhD. So I know a little bit about the difficulties of doing interdisciplinary research, to be in between domains and to invest doubly, in fact, to have to make yourself at home in two different disciplines and domains and then still produce something that's acceptable to both. But after my PhD, I've become involved in research policy and research agenda setting. So for governments who fund research with tax money, they have to decide what to fund, which research is the most important or valuable. So they need advice on that by experts, people that are in the knowledge production sector, in academics, but also from stakeholders and from industry. And then somehow figure out, yes, we should spend our money or the tax money on this topic rather than another one. And in the past couple of years, I've first worked for the European Science Foundation. So I've been involved in funding European projects. And again, this was agenda setting, but also a lot of evaluation of proposals. So which proposals are the best ones? Which ones should be funded? What is a good proposal? What is good knowledge? What's a good researcher? We make use of peer review processes. I can say more about that later. And there's lots to say about peer review in the knowledge production. And now I work for the Strasbourg Institute for Advanced Study, again, to fund fellowships, but also to create a community of scholars from very different backgrounds and to somehow bring them together and have them interact in a meaningful way, to kind of broaden the horizon of people that have been trained to specialize and to be very narrow. So that's an interesting challenge. So that's me. Okay. I would like to ask you the same.
Yeah, well, I come from a rather different background because in some cases the kind of peer review to which my own research is subject is from outside academia, in the sense that since a lot of my research has been about or done in association with different kinds of people's struggles, a movement against a large dam, slum dwellers and squatters organizations in Delhi who are fighting against evictions. They're the groups that hold me accountable. And so peer review by groups like these means that the research has to be made accountable to rather different publics than the peer review that would happen within an academic context. I think trying to bridge activism and research means having to deal with very different forms of public knowledge. And for me, this first became apparent when I did my first piece of research, which was in central India, looking at struggles against displacement by a large dam, struggles that involve very, very poor forest dwellers, many of whom belong to the scheduled tribes. And I found that in the case of that particular struggle, their own people's relationship with nature, their own knowledge of the river, the ways in which the river was central to their worldview, to their religion, all of that was treated as meaningless or trivial by decision makers who were focused much more on the engineering aspects and the economics of the project. And so this question of how you know a river, and do you know it through the embodied practices of everyday living around it? Do you know it because you love it? Or do you know it because you've done surveys that tell you what the volume of water in the river is, or what the cost of electricity generated, or the irrigation potential, etc. is? These conflicts in terms of knowledge about the river, in fact, brought home to me the way in which issues of knowledge and accountability become very important. So I wonder whether you face dilemmas, you said disciplinary dilemmas, in terms of thinking about different valuations.
Well, the positions that I've been working have been quite very much at a meta level. So there is, of course, things that happen, and there's people that study these things. They do research on them, and they, you know, they need to get funding, so they apply for grants. And then there is the level of people deciding on, you know, who gets the funding, doing peer review with academics. And above that, there's a layer of policymakers who determine whether there's funding in the first place. So I've been really at quite a high level of abstraction. And so the connection, you know, what's actually left from what is this about, is it's not lost, but it's a bit...
It's filtered.
It's filtered, and maybe it's distorted to some extent. And there are many layers between the, you know, funding and the actual research.
Right, but the layers are still there because it's meant to impose accountability of certain sorts, right?
Yeah, and a coordination to solve the coordination problem.
Right.
At first, we have to collect all the tax money, and then we have to divide it over the different policy areas, and research policy gets a little bit of money, and then they're like, okay, now we have to divide this money over some research, but, you know, maybe we should give it to cancer research because people are dying of cancer, especially in the West, you know. So let's do that rather than, you know, fund something about a dam in India and it's far away. So,
right.
So it's, yeah.
Right, yeah. So how do you see that process of prioritizing happening in the kinds of decisions that you make? I mean,
yeah, what I see is so we've been trying to program to develop themes within which people could apply for funding, and at European level, this is you know, policymakers really want to steer, and they want research to be relevant, and they don't really trust academics to find out themselves, this is an important topic or that is an important topic. They're like, yeah, you know, let us tell you what kind of topics you should work on, and then you can, you know, see how you do it. And typically this is, they collect a lot of experts, so academics, people from industry, people from the stakeholders who talk a lot all the time, and, you know, everyone's like, this is important, that's important, that's important. Then they create a document on which everyone has to agree, which is very difficult. So in the end, usually the document is quite bland and very general, because otherwise people cannot agree on it.
Right.
It's a compromise document.
Right.
And then some sort of, yeah, general thematic area has been identified and then is put out, and then people can apply for funding within that.
Right. Right. But in that process, do you find that the process of stakeholder identification is something where people themselves speak out, so that it's those who are the most aggressive or the most vociferous who, in a way, get to set the agenda?
Definitely. Yeah.
Large sections of the public actually couldn't even care what research is being funded or not funded.
Many people are not aware. And of course, there's a lot of lobbying going on. Not so much, I mean, there's also lobbying, really professional lobbying from industry, except for sure in the health industry, for example, there's lots going on there, because they all want public funding for health research that then they can commercialize for medication and so on. But the format of these kind of research agenda setting activities is such that there's a selection of who's being invited, and you kind of meet, you often meet the same people again and again. Like, oh, right. There's this person again, right. You know, so you have almost like professional stakeholders, so to speak, right. who each time, you know, tell their story, which is not, you know, wrong or so, but right. there's a quite a selection effect in who's being invited for this, is my impression.
Why is it happening? Why do you think that happens?
It's easier. And it's a network effect. Mm-hmm. People know it, and it's also choosing the channel for inviting people or for identifying who is a stakeholder. And some people are just really hard to get also because they're not interested in giving their opinion or they don't understand it.
Right.
And it's difficult to talk with them because the level of abstraction on which they think is not compatible with the level of abstraction of these discussions there.
Right.
And
so one has to be a certain kind of academic who can articulate concerns in a way that can be heard.
Yeah.
Within the frameworks of a certain academic
research bureaucracy. You have to translate it. Yeah. You have to translate it, and that's not really being done because it's a lot of effort, and it's also if you take this stakeholder, why not the other one? Because
right.
you have very particular views that might be representative or not. You don't actually know.
Right.
So you try to get people who are somehow representing a group, like representing employers, representing employees, unions or so. So you already work with representation, which is a selection.
Right.
And you know, so you again, you get a distortion or at least filtering
right.
that's going on.
Right. But looking at the system from outside, it seems to me that in some ways what seems to count in terms of getting academic grants is not so much the quality of the research, though of course that's important, but the ability of the researcher to be able to simply write a proposal in the particular bureaucratic format that's required. So that immediately means that a lot of people who might be doing extremely good research in a way get disqualified because they're not either conversant with the protocols for applying or they don't happen to be in the networks where they can call upon others to write in the manner that's prescribed for them. So there's a way in which I think there are hierarchies within the research community.
Yeah, there's several exclusion mechanisms which are not intended really, but that are very real. One of them is actually language. So I'm now working at a French university, but we do international peer reviews. So they have to write English proposals.
Right.
And especially the social sciences and humanities cannot write in English because that's not what they learn. They mm-hmm. do fantastic research in France. Very interesting, but you know, if you receive the proposal in English, it's very badly written, and it's also a very different structure. They have a very different culture of writing. So, and if you send that out into peer review, it does not get a good evaluation. And you know, so we really have to work very hard to somehow still keep it in or not. And it's a
right.
So language is definitely one thing, and you see it also in the funding at the European level. It's the UK, it's the Netherlands, mm-hmm. it's the Scandinavian countries. They're all very good in English, and they get a disproportionate amount of funding simply because they know how to write proposals and they control the language.
Right.
So
Well, and you know, looking at it from the other direction too, one can see that proficiency in English and also a certain kind of technical vocabulary in English is what drives and attracts funding when it comes to the Global South as well.
Yes.
There are all sorts of people whose, again, as I said, whose research could be extremely relevant, extremely well done, but because they don't have competence in a certain sort of disciplinary mode of expression, they get left out of the process.
Yeah.
So even as we talk about democratizing public knowledge, one keeps coming across the fact that there are certain, you know, bureaucratic modes of gatekeeping, which instead of actually being demolished or lowered, are in fact becoming harder and harder to scale.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things we notice in particular is the way in which now research grants tend to be available in larger amounts rather than smaller ones. So I think partly because of the economics of managing research, one finds that you get a few very large grants rather than lots of small grants, because I think the transaction costs of managing small grants is much more.
Yes.
Often what you need on the ground, in India at least, are lots of small grants.
Yes.
Because one may not have the administrative capacity to be able to manage large grants. The accounting mechanisms for large grants then mean that you have to spend money in particular ways. It also takes up a lot of time to be then managing the grant.
Yes.
And in fact, research then is ironically the casualty rather than the outcome of these sorts of budgeting formats.
Yes. What I see from being part of the system, it's a very much almost an industrialized system of knowledge production. So as you said, small grants are not attractive. They have a lot of overhead. It's a lot of administration. It's just not worth it. Mm-hmm. Because, research funding organizations are also looked at, like, how much do you give out and how much money do you cost yourself? And if you cost almost as much as the grant that you give out, then it's like, okay, this is not worth it. And it's, I think, more in general, the view on knowledge has become very economic. It's the production of knowledge, which is, of course, supposed to lead to innovation, which then in turn leads to economic growth, which is good. That's kind of the simplistic way of thinking that is very dominant. People know, yes, it's all a bit different, of course, but in the end, that's the basic rationale, I think. So knowledge has been discovered as the big economic asset, the driver of economic growth, the knowledge economy. And the same goes for education, actually. You see that, education is basically human capital formation. It's not, we don't want to give these people knowledge. We want them to work in a knowledge economy and make money and contribute to economic growth. So we're making human capital at universities, and this framing of knowledge production and knowledge dissemination as an economic activity, and this goes really far, right? Because universities get also paid per student, so they have an incentive of having more students and maybe lowering the level of their degrees so that more students are faster going in and out of the system so they get more money. So there's a kind of a perverse rationale that comes with this economic view on knowledge. So the good thing is that now there's lots of investment in knowledge. But the bad thing is that it kind of gives very strange dynamics and also some effects on the selection of topics. Because topics that are not immediately, or that you cannot defend in terms of impact, economic impact, are less easily funded.
Right. No, I agree. I think the way in which there's an instrumentalization of knowledge.
Yes,
that it must
that's
have,
the word,
economic effects that are visible in the short term,
in
a way undermines the very basis, of a knowledge economy in the longer term. In any case, using words like economy in the context of knowledge is to, I think, fall into the trap of actually replicating.
It's hard to avoid because you have to make decisions where to put money and where it will have the most effect. But then, what effect is the thing? So, for policymakers, it is difficult. They have to have some rationale to spend it on this rather than on that. But it has an effect that is not beneficial, also not for the knowledge system itself.
Yeah, but the thing is that at one level, I think the phrase knowledge economy or even the idea of innovation it becomes like a slogan after a while, an empty one, in the sense that innovation occurs in all kinds of ways.
Yes.
And only a few of them generate profits in some measurable way for some private corporation or for the state or something. There are all kinds of social innovations which transform lives in radical ways, and yet which are not amenable to the process of training and investment in quote-unquote human capital in quite the ways that the education and research establishments like to do.
Yes.
And yet that language, I think, of talking about innovation and talking about a knowledge economy seems to monopolize the concept of how knowledge is produced, as if it's only happening within these circuits which are officially recognized and officially funded.
Yes.
And tends to actually, I think, sever the connection between the more embodied, embedded forms of knowledge that are happening out there, and in fact denies them even more the recognition that they deserve.
Yes, well, they have a very different status, and they're also less easy to take into account because they're not in the right format to be digested, if, for right. example, by policymakers.
Right.
So it's difficult, and you know, the more knowledge there is, the more it's competing for being heard,
right.
and
right.
it's in that sense we also have a problem. There's so much knowledge; knowledge production has, you know, exploded really in the past decades. If you look at the publications and so on, but also the number of researchers, it's very difficult to control. So, I mean, nobody knows everything, of course, that was always the case, but now it's really, really fragmented. And it's...
Yeah, but I think, in a way, because in India we are seeing the shifts happen right now, which have perhaps happened earlier in Europe, some of the changes are therefore more apparent. I think what might have now become taken for granted is still something which is contested in India. So, for instance...
Good, maybe there's hope, no?
Well, I mean, the direction right now doesn't look particularly hopeful. But, for instance, you know, we have had a long tradition since the 1950s of state-funded research, which has been by and large independent. And now we find increasingly that the call is for so-called public-private partnerships,
yes.
in which case your research is supposed to generate external grants, and those external grants necessarily then shape the direction of the research. There may be money to study certain kinds of issues, but not others.
Yes.
And therefore there is... I think a compromise on the idea of independence, and sometimes even the call to be relevant in terms of contributing to policy causes a kind of distortion, because what is defined as policy is often very narrow in terms of economic and social policy,
mm-hmm.
so that all sorts of longer-term questions get left unaddressed, and
yes,
difficult
yes.
questions which are not... easily, you know, disaggregated into disciplinary boxes also get avoided, because it's hard to fit them into the patterns of funding, patterns that are supported by the private sector or by particular kinds of government research organizations now.
Yeah, this public-private partnerships is a way of governments, they say like, okay, it should have impact, should be relevant. If a private sector organization wants to put in money, then it must be relevant, because they only put their money when it, you know, when it will deliver something. So it's for them a way of saying, okay, it guarantees relevance. And the other thing is that they want more funding into research, but not from tax money, but from the businesses, because they're like, well, these businesses profit from the knowledge. Well, they better pay for it. So, I mean, the intentions are not bad, but the effects are, as you described, that it limits what you can do in your topics, and also it limits your independence, because you might find things that are not fitting with the interests of the private party, and then, yeah, what to do.
Right. Well, you know, since we've been asked to think about public knowledge and the democratization of knowledge, then the question arises, if the public is being defined for us in terms of, you know, private corporations, or in terms of these very selective bodies of scientific research and, you know, peer review and so on, what other kinds of publics exist out there for us to include and to be answerable to?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the Indian case, I see the huge amount of civil society mobilization, resistance, struggle, as in some ways acting as a counter-public, a public that says, well, these are the issues that we think are relevant and that we would like academics to address through their work.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Europe, do you find counter-publics that seek to reorganize research and the ways in which research grant organizations work?
I wouldn't say counter-powers. I think it depends also for what type of research. So research that's directly relevant, for example, on a dam or on urban issues, I think there's a clear audience for that and a clear stakeholder also and a clear interest. There's other research, and this is especially, of course, in the hard sciences, which is, it doesn't have a clear audience. People don't even understand it, and they. Right. So, to some extent, of course, society is. There's a division of labor. There's people who, you know, are bakers and butchers and electricians, and there's people who are researchers and they do research, and, you know, they do their thing, and we trust them to do it right, and we all are better off with the specialization. So, to some extent, I think the separation of the spheres is inevitable and necessary, and to some extent even good, I think, because, you know, if the general audience was going to tell researchers what they should work on, they might not have the best ideas. You know, so right. That's
right. Well, I'm not sure I agree, because I think that there's a danger sometimes of becoming self-referential. Because, mm-hmm. you know, as academics, we're already in a privileged position, and that tendency gets reinforced if we talk only to ourselves. And there's a kind of ivory tower effect that I think comes into play. The only way in which one can guard against that and avoid that, I think, is to be asked by electricians and by bakers and plumbers, well, what do you do? And yeah. can you explain it to me yeah. in simple words that I can that I can understand?
Which
I
is a healthy exercise.
Yeah, a theoretical yes. physicist yeah. may not be able to do it.
No, it's no. Mathematics gets a bit in trouble there.
But a cultural studies person probably couldn't do it.
No, maybe not. No.
Yeah, I think. Or somebody who does, you know, film studies or something.
No, but you have to be able to explain to others and yourself what are you doing? I mean, it doesn't have to be in all the details or so. And it's something we do also with the fellows of this institute where I work now, that they have to present to the other fellows from other backgrounds. Mm-hmm. It's difficult for them, but it's a great exercise because they have to reflect on, okay, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? What does it mean? You know, what is the relevance? But about the self-referentiality, one thing that I see is the system of peer review, where you get proposals, mm-hmm. Requests for funding. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot happening there, which may not be optimal. So what happens is, of course, you have to send out these proposals to people in the field. Now, one thing that happens is that nobody has time, because there has been an increase of this grant based funding, as opposed to more basic funding, which you just get your salary and do whatever you think is right. So you have to apply for a lot of grants and write a lot of proposals, which all have to be evaluated by the same people, you know, of the academic community. So nobody has time because they're busy writing their own grant proposals and they don't want to evaluate. So if you're lucky, at some point you find people who want to do it, but often you already skip the real, like, the people that are very good in their field, like, okay, they're never going to do it.
Yeah.
So you go down in a level. You also select on language. They have to understand English.
Right.
And they have to be known. And often, you know, people that are in Spain and publish in Spanish, at the European level, you wouldn't know that they're experts in whatever it is, because you don't speak Spanish and you don't know it. So there's a big selection there with lots of referees from, again, the countries that I mentioned before that are used to work in English. So they have a disproportionate vote in this evaluation of these proposals. And then, of course, there's the thing that if there's a proposal in your domain, and it is, because otherwise they wouldn't ask you, right? You're like, maybe it's not great, but, you know, it's my domain, and I find my domain so fascinating, and sure, it should be fun, so it's very good, you know? Mm-hmm. And also, like, if I don't say very good, the funding will go to another domain, and I think our domain needs some more.
Right.
So you get a distortion also in evaluation that people are saying, you know, overdoing it. Or sometimes you get the opposite, of course, that you're like, oh, this is my competition. So let's just say this is not very good, because actually I'm doing this, and I want to have the grant funding for this, so... No, and this doesn't really even each other out, and this gives all kinds of different effects that you may not want. Now, no system is perfect, and it's the least imperfect system, but I think especially the volume of peer review is a big problem.
Right.
And people don't take the time also. They're like, oh no, I have 10 review reports to write, and I can't do this anymore. And you know, we don't send them to people in India, for example, or... Yeah, well, in India they speak English very well, but still, it's just much less transparent and accessible.
Right.
And it's always the usual suspects who are asked for reviewing.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, this to me is like, I mean, public knowledge, but it's like a public secret, right? Everybody knows what you've just said,
mm-hmm.
but nobody actually quite acknowledges it as mm-hmm. a problem that, you know, that needs to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in a way, the problem gets perpetuated. It gets reproduced because the same people are willing to go to collaborate in the
yes.
system, and everybody's complicit.
Yes, and those who get grants get more grants because, you know, peer reviewers look at the CV. They're like, oh, you know, they had publications grants. It must be a good person. So, yes, let's say this is good because I don't have time to really look at it. So,
right.
so there's a really, kind of a...
Right, so what gets rewarded is the ability to get grants.
Yes.
With more grants.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
yes.
you know, so somewhere the system is in trouble in a way, right?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's still working and in spite of it. I mean, people that go into academics, in the end, they do want to do good research and they're really curious and so on. So it's they're not going there for the money or so. So I think in the end, it's still not too bad, but it is distorting. And yeah. But this public secret idea, that's interesting. I think that's also related to not so much the funding and so on, but more of the results of research.
Mm-hmm.
That, and I was thinking that, for example, your type of research might have like unwelcome results that are not really welcomed by policymakers, for example, or by funders actually also. And maybe, you know, that then get ignored, or people know of it, but it's not picked up by the media, or it is, but people just don't want to deal with it somehow. And there's quite some public secrets.
Yeah.
People know it, but it doesn't do anything.
That's right. I think a lot of research which points towards complex, intractable problems, which aren't amenable to simple solutions, often gets ignored for that very reason, because it doesn't tell you in black and white terms what to do, because it requires...
Or what to think, or how to feel about it, yeah.
Yeah, and also things which are politically difficult to do, systemic change, when that's called for. And I think, therefore, the tendency... is with that sort of research, the reception is often one of, a sense of discomfort, which is then followed by a kind of misrecognition, as in, yes, thank you, let's move on to the next one. So
yeah.
It's sort of
yes.
willful ignorance that we don't want to quite go there.
No.
And I see this also in disciplinary terms. So, for instance, as an anthropologist, I work in an institute where most of my colleagues are economists. And often what my work shows, or the work of other sociologists and anthropologists, is that many of the fundamental assumptions that economists make when dealing with, say, the valuation of environmental resources, etc., are very hard to sustain on the ground, be it in terms of ecological value, be it in terms of cultural value. There's a certain incommensurability that
the
comes
unmeasurable
in.
Values that
exactly.
are not taken into account
exactly.
because it's just too complicated.
That's right. But rather than acknowledge that complication and acknowledge, therefore, the limits of research, I find that many of my colleagues say, well, you know, those exist, but we can't quite deal with that. So let's deal with what we can measure and what we can calculate. And therefore, it's, you know, a little bit like searching for your car keys that you dropped somewhere in the dark, but searching for them under the light.
Because the light's light there, yes. Yeah. That's what you economists do. Yes. Economists, right? No, economists are notorious for doing that. Economists have a big problem anyway, that they want to be like the hard sciences, so they're very mathematical. And
yeah, so I think that in some ways too is a problem of misrecognition, that you know that there are limits in terms of a disciplinary boundary that prevents you from being able to engage with certain crucial aspects of what is at issue.
Yeah.
But rather than think of how to try and transcend those boundaries, there's a tendency to retract and to mm-hmm. stay safe within that. And yet we find that, given the sort of hierarchy of knowledge, people who come up with numbers, people who come up with things which can be measured and calculated, engineers, economists, are the ones who are, the most, who are the ones who are welcomed by
yes.
policymakers, because they give them what they need, which
yes.
is the authority and the legitimacy of what seem to be concrete numbers of
yeah.
facts, which are devoid of complexity and devoid of uncertainty.
Yeah.
And so those of us who deal with in disciplines where our fundamental instinct is to try and complicate things, find that we're actually pushed to the margins, because complexity is often unwelcome.
It's not welcome, no, but it's also because then they're like, what should we do? Because, it's all very complex, and that's kind of paralyzing when it gets complex. And of course, that should be the challenge of policymakers, to take it into account and to have some sort of wisdom to then take the right decision. But that's not how policy works generally. And they want to justify and legitimate whatever their policy is, and numbers help.
Right.
And it's
right.
just easier to do it that way.
Right.
And,
yeah. No, I agree that at the end, the question often is, well, what should be done?
Yes.
And to answer that question, one has to,
simplify. That depends. It's really complex. So, and they're like, okay, so what is it and what should we do?
Yeah, but I think the world can actually deal with complexity. In fact, we deal with complexity all the time. And yet we find that in certain crucial areas of decision-making, public decision-making, often that complexity is, willfully shut out.
Yes.
And I think that happens because it's often profitable to do so, and it's convenient to do so in ways that are quite self-serving. So, there's a certain pattern to the kinds of complexities that get left out. Other kinds of complexities are often entertained, be it about political calculations. Is this going to benefit my vote share in the next elections? Or, how is this going to place me in relation to other competitors? Companies make complex decisions all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that kind of complexity is something that they're willing to engage with.
Yes.
Whereas other kinds of complexity, social complexity, cultural complexity, seems to be quite easy to
ignore.
Dismiss and
yes.
ignore.
Yes.
So I think there's a certain politics to what gets simplified and what remains.
Yeah, could even go further and say that policymakers have certain ideas of what they would like to do and just search for those research results that support this and ignore others, and
right.
a selective shopping for arguments.
Absolutely.
And then say, okay, well, this is research, so it's true. And I think most policymakers are, I don't know, it's hard to generalize, but I don't think most policymakers are evil or so. It's very often it's more of a subconscious mechanism, I think. Well, maybe I'm being naive here, but we all choose what suits us best
yeah.
in the end. And
yeah. No, I don't think it's a question of being evil, but I think it's a question of surviving, and often surviving by falling into what are comfortable ways of doing things.
Yeah.
Into easy habits of mind. And often if the systems within which we operate, the people we talk to, fall within those comfortable spaces, then often those bad decisions happen, not because we're evil per se, but because we become lazy. And therefore, the question to me, for me, really is, how can we force ourselves to remain honest and to remain accountable? And I think to do that, one must always somehow be made uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Made uncomfortable by different kinds of realities impinging and puncturing the comfortable worlds in which we move. Made accountable by other publics asking questions and asking us why we do what we do and, you know, what relevance that has for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very easy for us to, in a way, stay within worlds that we create for ourselves. It's yes. often rewarding to do that too.
And punished if you don't. Yeah, because it's, of course, also a social system in which you do things in a certain way and not in other ways, in which you interact with certain groups and not with other groups. And also, it's as you say, it's a form of laziness. It's just extra effort. It's also psychologically not comfortable. You're like, oh, you know, I thought I figured it out, but then there's this new information that doesn't really fit, whatever. Okay, whatever. And it's... And many things are just also structured in procedures that do not have opening once a certain phase of openness has been closed, and then it goes into a system which is not open anymore.
Right. And tell me, as a funder, do you see fashions in academic research?
Yes, fashions. I mean, there's, of course, this kind of window dressing. So, you know, when there's funding for environmental stuff, everything is suddenly green, you know, and or has some sort of... It's funny, you're like, really? I've seen this before, and now suddenly it's a green proposal. And so they play the game to get funding. They write it in a certain way that it fits with the criteria. So would definitely... that could be like fashions. I see a lot of conservatism, I think. That people, an idea should, a research proposal should be a bit new, because otherwise it's not good either, but not too new, because then, you know. And what I also see is that people who are in a certain discipline, who kind of venture out, want to do another topic than their own topic. It's like, yeah, but, you know, he didn't work on that, so why... You know, this is not his thing. So you're being punished if you try to go outside of your topic and you don't get funding for it because they look at what you did before.
Right.
And being interdisciplinary is not an attractive option usually for researchers because it's an extra investment. And everyone talks about it, that it should be, and it, you know, and funders are all over the place. But if you see in the end what's funded, it's not so interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. It's disciplinary with a little plus, you know, that they take an extra factor into account or so. Mm. But in the end, also, because of the peer review, there's quite a conservative effect on what gets funded in the end.
Why? Because of peer review?
Because people then they're looking at it and saying like, oh, what's that? Mm. It's an economist who wants to do some social stuff, you know, and then they're like, no, you know, because you always have to say, do you think that this researcher can do this research?
Right.
And then, you know, you say like, well, maybe not. Yeah. And it's they look at your past to determine whether you're fit for funding and also for the topic.
I see.
And if you come with a topic that you never worked on, then people... So it's very difficult to change. You are rewarded for specialized, be specialized, and you learn a trick and then like a model or method, and you just milk it out. You know, you apply your model to 10 different things. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very similar, but it's a bit different enough so that you can publish.
Right.
You know, and then you have 10 publications, which is good because you need it, because otherwise you will not get a position. So you milk out your trick for 10 years, and then you're like, okay, maybe now it's really gone, and I try a little other trick, and then I do that for a couple of years. And this is very cynic, and this is to be provocative, but that's what we see a lot. People just are like packaging existing research, you know, it sounds a bit different title, some addition thing.
And least publishable.
Another journal. There's so many journals. So and there you go. There's your CV.
Right.
So
any final words? I think we've been asked to wind up. So any final words on public
About also about the Anthropocene. I'm of course very curious to see what will happen with this experiment, which I applaud on one end, and the other hand. which I have a fearful heart for, to see where it will end up, because students are also quite rational in my experience when I was still teaching at university. They are there to learn something that they can work on later, to make them money, basically, or at least to have a job. And to be an anthropocenist, or I don't know what you would be if you would do such a curriculum, is in the end maybe not attractive to do. But I don't know. I keep an open mind, and I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
And
well,
how about you?
100 people here attending the course.
Yes,
of course,
yes.
Not all of them are students, but they're all... Well, they're coming at it from different perspectives, but also many artists, many people working in mediums other than in media other than academia.
Yeah.
And I think that there's been a very stimulating discussion in terms of how the Anthropocene changes the ways in which we think about the world. It doesn't translate into something which is actionable right now, and therefore maybe the priorities that it directs our attention to are rather specialized or limited to a few people. But actually I'm quite, you know, inspired by the fact that people are willing to entertain this idea and think it through without necessarily thinking of, well, what's in it for me in terms of either a job or in terms of some kind of, you know, sort of benefit in the immediate way. I mean, I think
also I've been dealing with a select population of students which were economics and business students, and they are very different. So I do also think we have a selection here of particular people. And it's good. I also wonder if the Anthropocene should not be something that should be part of high school curriculum at a bit earlier phase, because basically it's to give fundamental knowledge about the world, and I think it should be at high school, because lots of people don't go to university, but they still should have some awareness of this, and I think it would fit in geography, languages, why not something like that,
Oh, definitely. I think it does need to circulate much more, because it has the potential to sort of fundamentally change how one understands and acts.
Yes, and now what I see is that it's very much into kind of science of science, like it's about concepts and abstractions and interdisciplinarity and so on. And I think it should be at that level, because we're dealing with a certain way in which research is organized, which, you know, needs to change in order to understand and deal with our reality. At the same time, I think that it could also be taught on a lower level of abstraction, more in terms of awareness, but maybe to high school level. And because now it's more of a philosophy of science, art. It's still quite contained in its own world.
Right.
So I have the feeling it's still quite contained in a quite a particular world.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. It needs to spread out, and it needs to be grounded much more. So
it's
earthbound knowledge in the sense of bringing home to people the immediacy of what's being discussed here, and making the connections to their own lives, perhaps.
Maybe geography is not so bad. I mean, we do learn about the Holocene and all the other scenes. I remember this from high school, so why not enter it at that level? So I'm curious what will happen.
What will happen now, right?
I don't know. I'm not sure if the 5 minutes are over.
I thought they were over long ago.
Yes. There's much more to be said. And I think a lot of people also are in denial. We briefly discussed this before we sat down in this table, that the Anthropocene, on the one hand, it's a fashionable thing to say, the Anthropocene and everything's connected and so on and so forth. On the other hand, it's, of course, a dramatic thing, because it puts such a burden of responsibility on us then. And, it's actually quite a depressing idea that we're so important, because we have issues with controlling ourselves and our behavior in our societies, even, people among each other. So how can we ever expect that we will take responsibility for the world, for the geology of the world? It's to me, it's quite daunting or quite scary idea in many ways.
Well, I don't think people will take responsibility unless in some ways they're compelled to do so, be it by ecological crises that are, you know, more immediately affect them.
Yeah.
Or because of pressure from people who've, in a way, who're dealing with the consequences of what has happened.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of resistance from either the material world or from the social
but
world
the people
has
that,
to come about.
Yeah, the people that have power and money do not suffer these consequences so much. They read about it. They might worry about it or not,
right,
but they don't feel it.
Right. So you're saying those are the people who are discussing the Anthropocene concept?
It's a bit of a, you know, it's easy to sit here and talk about it, you know. For you, you're much closer to the reality than for me, who, you know, I don't notice much of the problems that are ongoing. The glaciers are melting, but I don't notice it. And so it's not very real. And we can round up anytime.
Yeah.
But we can also go on for an hour, actually. So.
Yeah. Okay.
It's weird because we don't see any of them.
It's very disconcerting to not be able to see
people. We move? All right.